Man was pushing a shopping cart in a grocery store, and he had his screaming, bouncing little baby boy in the cart. And he kept repeating such calming admonitions. He says, "Don't yell, Brian. Calm down, Brian. Don't get excited, Brian. It's going to be okay, Brian." Well, there was a lady that was shopping that was kind of watching what was going on, and she'd come around the aisle and went up to him, and she said, "Sir, I just want to commend you for trying to be so calm and to soothe your little son, Brian." And the man looked her in the eye, and he said, "Lady, I'm Brian." Now, those that are parents can relate to that story. And I'm sure that there have been some of you been in that kind of a situation. And it reminds us how difficult parenting is. It's a demanding, draining job. And yet it is the most valuable and exciting and rewarding, really, of all jobs. And so tonight, as we continue our study of home improvement, we want to talk about raising kids without raising your blood pressure. Now, I have preached this before, as you can probably imagine, and I have been called upon this title. And so I want you to know I'm a little bit like President Trump with this. I speak in hyperbole. So don't get too worried about the title of this lesson. But we're trying to make a point as we think about how that we can calmly and the very best of our ability be able to raise our children. It's good to see you tonight. I will confess to you that I am still adjusting to these post-COVID assemblies and times, situations. You know, as you know, we've been traveling, and I'm not doing located work anymore. And during all of this, from March really through about August, we've spent our time kind of in the mountains and attended little country churches and have preached for these churches. And in fact, when we were in the Smokies, Cock County only had 2 cases when we got there of COVID. They got a few more after that. And then when we were out in Montana, when we got there, the entire state had only had 800 cases, the entire state. So we have not been quite used to, you know, the situations and the lockdowns and the mask and, you know, so many people watching online. At least I hope we have people watching online. I'm told that we do. And so if you're out there tonight, we're glad to have you tuned in. And I hope that the things we say will be helpful to you. And I appreciate the opportunity the elders have accorded me to be able to share these vital topics. What I want to do tonight as we look at this is to really look at the idea of raising our children. And I have 6 points that all start with the letter A. And these 6 points really speak to the relationship, the divine relationship that we see between the Father and the Son and between the Father and Son and you and I. And I believe that we have a divine model that will teach us how that we ought to parent. And so let's begin with the first one. The first A is the word acceptance. And the question I have for you tonight is, do you love your child because of what they do or because of who they are? And the difference between those two is this. Unconditional acceptance is based on who your child is. He is a human being created into the image of God, and he's endowed, or she's endowed, with value and worth and dignity and a soul that will live in eternity. And acceptance is important because it develops security. And it builds trust between the parent and the child. If, on the other hand, we focus on what they do for acceptance, then this in turn is going to breed insecurity and a lack of self-worth. I suggest to you from a biblical standpoint that God accepts us unconditionally as his children. In Romans 15 and verse 7, he says, accept one another, then just as Christ accepted you, in order to bring praise to God. And as I think about this idea of his acceptance of his children and his divine family, I think about, do I deserve God's love? John 3:16 said, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. That we haven't done anything to deserve God's love, but God has loved us. In fact, even if we're not in his family, his love for all people is an unconditional love. Do we merit the sacrifice of Christ? Romans 5:8 said that God commended his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. I have done nothing in and of my own works and my own merit to merit the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and what he did for me on the cross. And yet he went to the cross and did that. And then we ask the question, did we earn our salvation? Ephesians 2 and verse 8 says, by grace are you saved through faith, not of yourselves. It is a gift of God. Now, I know typically when we're studying with people and someone talks to us about being saved by grace, we like to point to other passages that have to do with our salvation. And I don't deny any of those tonight, and certainly we understand in this room tonight of everything that's involved in salvation, both on God's part and man's part. But the fact of the matter is that Paul is pointing out to the Ephesians that it's by God's unmerited favor that you've been saved. We cannot earn our salvation. And all of our works, being baptized, coming to every service, giving financially of our means, being discipled, reading the Bible every day, praying every day. I mean, all the good things we might do, we can't get to the end of life and say, Lord, I've earned it. You got a place in heaven for me because look at all that I've done. I've earned salvation. There's not a one of us that can say that and brag that before God. And so I suggest, ladies and gentlemen, this is a divine standard. That if God has that kind of acceptance for us, then in raising our children, we need to learn that kind of acceptance as well. There are some false standards in the world that oftentimes, if we're not careful, we buy into. And I'm just going to bullet these a little bit. But physical appearance. And our children's friends or their peer group often judge them on that, and we need to be careful that we don't judge our children on their physical appearance, on their height or their weight or how they look or other such things as that, because plenty of people in the world are going to do that. And we know from experience, those of us that are adults, that a person that is handsome, good-looking, or pretty is often looked at with greater admiration than someone, at least by the world standards, that doesn't reach that level that the world looks at. So let's be careful we don't judge on that. And then we've already suggested the idea of performance. But once again, we have to be careful as our children get older and they get involved in activities. And it may be soccer, it may be basketball, it may be football, it may be volleyball. Maybe it's not sports, maybe it's music, it's a piano recital or voice or whatever. Whatever it is that they're involved in, if we're not careful, we start judging them upon their performance, how well that they did. And of course, even grades can fall into that. And again, I have to be careful of this because I don't want to undermine what your parents are trying to do, encourage your children to get good grades. But you know, some are just better than others. God's blessed some of us with great intellect and some of us with not so great intellect. You know, I was watching the hearings today of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and she graduated from Notre Dame Law School summa cum laude, isn't it? Or was it magna cum laude? Magna cum laude, I think. And I think about it, I graduated from college, Lottie, how come? I mean, you know, you just kind of barely make it under the wire there a little bit. My parents, You know, some parents expect their children to get straight A's. And I've actually known parents get upset when their kids got a B. Well, when I got a B, my parents threw a party. I mean, they were excited. You didn't get all C's this time, you got a B. So let's don't have unrealistic expectations of our children. And position. This is certainly something in the world that we look at, but it starts early. It starts in school many times of the social status, a social position and acceptance one has. And then certainly possessions is something. And we're judged by that oftentimes. You know, if you take your kids to school and you're driving a 10-year-old rusted out Chevrolet, your kids kind of know that you haven't arrived yet. Your ship hasn't come in. And other kids judge them on that. But we need to be careful that we don't make possessions the be-all, end-all. If we just had more possessions, then we'd be better. These are all false standards of acceptance. Dr. Charles Stanley, in his book on the home, tells a true story about a father asking him to talk to his son that he was having some problems with. The boy was rebellious. He was having trouble with his grades. In fact, he had been expelled from school. And so the father brought the boy in to sit there with Dr. Stanley in his office and to talk. And as they were sitting there, finally Dr. Stanley asked the boy, who was very quiet, to briefly describe himself. And he says, after a long silence, he uttered this dismal label. A nobody. A nobody. The dejected boy, he writes, continued to discuss his problem. But the first words, Dr. Stanley said, described his need. His father was an impulsive, quick-tempered, insensitive, dictatorial man that destroyed the boy's sense of worth. And so he raises the question, why would that boy want to please his father? And who can stand being treated as a nobody? Acceptance teaches us to follow the advice of the wise man, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. That passage has been the source, I think, of a great deal of misunderstanding today, and I've had parents sometimes wring their hands and come to me and wonder what they did wrong, because their children had grown up and gone to college and got married, left home, of course, and had quit the church. I must have done something wrong, because it says here that if you train a child in the way that he should go, he's not going to depart when he gets older. Well, there's a couple things wrong with that exegesis, that verse. Number one, the book of Proverbs are general ruling principles. They're axioms. And they're not presented to us as being 100% accurate in every single situation, circumstance, and case. And we know that so because there's some proverbs that give you opposites right after each other. Like one toward the end of the book, I think it's chapter 30, says, answer a fool according to his folly. But the very next verse says, don't answer a fool according to his folly. Well, it depends on judgment. And so there's a lot of proverbs that the wise man gives that are basic principles of life, but he's not saying that they're absolute, and the Holy Spirit has saw fit to record those and give them to us as general ruling principles. But I've come to the conclusion that I think there's a second thing wrong with our interpretation of that verse. And I agree with Albert Barnes that makes the point. The way that he should go, Barnes says, is according to the tenor of his way. That is the path especially belonging to, especially fitted for, the individual's character. Barnes goes on to say that the proverb enjoins the closest possible study of each child's temperament and adaptation of his way of life to do that. And so we should train and we should educate and initiate what is best for the child and using his talents, gifts, skills, and abilities. I think that's really what it's talking about, and it's not necessarily talking about spiritual training. And so you look at a child, in other words, and I'll use myself as an example. Wouldn't it have been something if my parents had tried to force me in to the field of music? And you say, well, what would have been so wrong with that? Well, nothing except I can't carry a tune in a bushel basket. I have all my life shown no aptitude for music. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, it's so bad when our grandson had his sixth birthday the other day and we were FaceTiming with them. And so we were singing happy birthday. They were singing at the party and we were on FaceTime. And Norma kind of punched me and she said, don't sing so loud. And it was just happy birthday to our family. But I'm terrible. But can you imagine? But I've seen parents, maybe they're musically inclined, and so they're trying to force their kids into music, and they don't have that aptitude, you see. Now, what my parents did let me do is play basketball. See? Now, I don't know if I had a lot of aptitude or not, but in Indiana, you and probably Kentucky too, if you're getting out of playing basketball, say, if you're tall. And so I had a problem that I had to kind of watch myself a little bit, and my wife helped me with this, of not trying to force our son into playing basketball because I liked it so much and because it's the best sport in the world. See, I had to be careful of that. But I did send him some camps to try to encourage him that he might grow in that area. You see, this is what the wise men there are talking about. To understand your child's gifts and talents, skills, ability, temperament, his intellectual ability, all of that. And then train him up in a way that he should go. I believe that's what it is talking about. Acceptance says, I love you for who you are. You are somebody special to me. And I value my relationship with you. That is acceptance. Well, we got five more to go, so I need to pick up the pace a little bit. All right? The second A is appreciation. And appreciation is a Bible principle, and this was God's attitude toward his son. You remember when Jesus came to be baptized of John, and it came up out of the water, and the Spirit came in a bodily form like a dove, and the voice of God thundered from heaven and said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Now, you remember Jesus was 30 years old when he came to be baptized. He began his ministry. He was 30 years old. The last time we saw Jesus in Scripture was at age 12. You remember when he got separated from his parents and they came back to Jerusalem, to the temple, and there he was at age 12 disputing with the religious leaders. And then it says that he went back to Nazareth and was subject to them, and he grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and with man. And we know just from little hints that he worked in the carpenter shop, and he apparently learned that trade. His father, Joseph, earthly father, was a carpenter. And Jesus learned that trade, and he worked in the carpenter shop. So that's what he was doing for 18 years. Now, do you think God was saying that he was only pleased that he finally got baptized? No, I think he's been pleased with Jesus all this time. I mean, all the way through his life. As he was subject to his earthly parents, grew in wisdom, stature, and favor with God and man, all during that 18-year period, that God was well pleased. And so we see the principle there of appreciation. And so here's a statement for you. I need to learn to appreciate my child's effort more than his accomplishment. Paul expresses his appreciation for his spiritual family in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 3. He said, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. And so I need to work to do that and to show appreciation. In the book, Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World, Stephen Glenn and Jane Nelson make this particular point. They write, children feel encouraged when we see them as assets rather than objects, see mistakes as opportunities to learn rather than as failures, invite participation and contributions rather than directing and demanding compliance. I think that's a pretty good statement. Some of you parents may have seen this. I'm carrying this around. I came across this back when our children were young, and they are now 47 and 42, so I've had this a long time. And it's 101 ways to praise your child. Have you all seen this before? 101 ways to praise. You can Google it and find it. But what it is try to encourage us as parents to think of creative ways to show appreciation. And I won't read all 101, but a few of them say, you're great, you're special, awesome, great job, keep up the good work, you're a winner, super, outstanding, marvelous, you're on the right track, you're really showing your talents, that's a great idea, good thinking. I've never seen anyone do it as well as you. What a great learner. What a great son, great daughter, great effort. You made my day. Great improvement. Perfect. And on it goes. 101 of these. And it's really good. It really kind of helps you to think about how that you can show appreciation for the things that your children do. Well, the third A is the A of affection. And we certainly see many times in the Bible how God expresses his affection for us. The Old Testament is filled with expressions of this, and especially in the book of Psalms. One of these is Psalm 145 and verse 9, where the psalmist said, the Lord is good to all, and he has compassion on all he has made. And the word compassion and merciful and loving kindness are words that are repeated over and over and over again to show God's feelings and emotion and affection for us. When Jesus came on the scene, how many times does it say that Jesus looked at someone and he had compassion for them? And so as parents, we should model affection before our children. Now, what that means is this, what we already talked about in the earlier lessons. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, love your children. Older women, teach the younger women to love their children. All of that. And what this does is this helps them see the importance of affection. Now, I mentioned this Sunday morning that as our kids get a little bit older, teenagers, they don't seem to like open public displays of affection quite as much, especially around their friends. I will tell you, any of you have teenage children, don't worry about that because they'll grow out of that. Our kids went through that. Dad, Mom, because they don't want to be embarrassed around their friends. They want to be cool, right? But what happens when they get a little bit older and they grow up and they probably maybe get in college or you get through college, then they will come back and will show affection to you again. So don't worry about that little interim period there. Just pick and choose your times to do that. But let them know that you love them. You know, I'll never forget when our son was a senior in high school and he was dating a young lady in high school, and he told me, and I don't know how this came up, but we frequently, when we would leave each other or something, just say, I love you. I mean, we just frequently told each other we loved each other. And he told me that his girlfriend had heard us say that one time when she was over at the house and they were leaving. And she told him, she's 18 year old now, she had never in her entire life heard her dad say, I love you. Can you believe that? Can you imagine? And they were members of the Lord's church. They were, I preached. They were both Christians and she was a Christian. But at 18 years old, it stood out to her that we told Kenny, I love you. And she told him, I've never heard my dad say that to me. How sad. How sad. Guys, don't be such a macho man that you can't tell your sons and your daughters you love them. And certainly your wife that you love her. Learn to demonstrate affection. Well, the fourth A is availability. Do you know how to spell the word love? That's the way you spell it. Be available. Have time to invest with your family. Ephesians 5:16 says, redeem the time because the days are evil. The word redeemer means to buy up. To buy up the time, to use the time wisely. Why? Because the days are evil. And so the question is raised, how much time do we spend with our children? Cornell University a number of years ago did a study where they attached little microphones to kids. And they monitored the kids for weeks. And they found in that particular study that the average American father spent 37.7 seconds a day talking to his children. I find that incredible that that could actually be the case. And yet very possibly it is. Spend time. You know, there's a saying that has become almost a proverb that no man ever said on his deathbed, I wish I spent more time at the office. But many a man has said, I wish I spent more time with my family. I wish I spent more time with my kids. I used to have a cartoon. I don't know. It's probably buried in my storage unit, in my file cabinet somewhere. But I remember what it said. It was a family circus cartoon. And I had a picture of a dad sitting in his easy chair reading the newspaper. So you know how old this cartoon is. If it was today, the dad would probably be on his iPhone, right? But the caption, and there was a little boy standing there with a baseball mitt and his ball. And the caption was, Dad, when you're ready to play catch, I'll be outside getting older. Now, doesn't that tug at you just a little bit? Spend time with your kids. Be available. You know, our Heavenly Father, we talk about God is always there when we need Him. Now, we can't be omnipresent, like Psalm 145:18 says that God is near to us when we call on Him. But we can do our very best to be there when our kids need us and to hear them when they hurt and they want to talk. I have in my files a letter that was written by a runaway son to his parents. This is an actual letter. And it reads like this. Dear folks, thank you for everything, but I'm going to Chicago and try to start some new kind of life for myself. You asked me why I did the things that I did that got me in trouble and why I gave you so much static while I was at home. The answer is easy for me to give you, but I don't know if you'll understand. Remember when I was about 6 or 7 years old and I used to want you to just listen to me? I remember all the nice things you gave me for Christmas and my birthday, and I was really happy with those things for about a week. But the rest of the time during the year, all I wanted was you. I just wanted you to listen to me like I was somebody who felt things. Because I remember when I was young, I felt things. But you were always busy. And you never seemed to have time. Mom, you're a wonderful cook. And you always have everything so clean. But you were so tired from doing all of those things that made you busy. But you know something, Mom? I would have liked crackers and peanut butter just as well. If you'd only sat down with me a while during the day and said to me, tell me about it. Maybe I can help you understand. I think all the kids are doing so many things that grown-ups are tearing out their hair and worrying about are really looking for somebody who will have time to listen a few minutes and who will really treat them as they would a grown-up who might be useful to them, you know. Well, if anybody asks you where I am, just tell them I've gone looking for somebody with time because I've got a lot of things I want to talk about. Love to you all, your son. Be available. Spend time with your kids. And then accountability. Children need to learn accountability. Now, accountability has to do with two fundamental things. One is submission, and the other is obedience. Now, I'm going to give you a biblical passage and application of this. In Ephesians 5 and verse 21, it says, submitting to one another in the fear of God. But you know what the next verse says? See, the next verse is the one, when you see it, everybody knows it. And it says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. Now, we know that verse about wives submitting to their husbands, but the verse before says, submit to one another in the fear of God, and in the same breath, in the same context. Now, we think of children obeying their parents and submitting, but submitting to one another? How about a husband submitting to his wife? Or how about parents submitting to their children? Let me explain to you what I think this means about submitting to one another. I need to be accountable to my family for my attitudes and my actions. I don't have the right as the head of my house to run roughshod over the feelings of my family. That's not headship, that's dictatorship. And so accountability teaches me that I sometimes need to submit to the desires and the wishes and the needs. We talked the other night about understanding our wives' needs and understanding even our children's needs. And so when I understand those, there is actually a submission because I'm accountable. Now, I'll give you a simple example we all understand. When a child is born, and there they are, a little baby, what do? Well, we're submitting to them all the time, aren't we? They cry, you know, we change their diaper, we cry, we feed them, we cry, we can't figure out why we're crying, they're crying, and try to soothe them. And so we're submitting to them all the time. And there is a sense, although we certainly teach children as they grow to obey their parents and submit to the authority of their parents, but you see, the submission here is not authority, but it's in service. And so while there is a principle of authority that wives submit to their husbands and children submit to their parents, in terms of ministry, in terms of service, we submit to each other. We serve the needs of one another. Just like Jesus said that he came not to be served, but to serve. He is the epitome and the example of ministry and service. So I suggest kids need to learn responsibility in three basic areas. One is in attitudes. The children need to learn that they're responsible for their own attitudes. Now, I know children get cranky and they get upset about something and all this, but it's important as early as possible to start helping them understand they're responsible for their feelings. They're responsible for their attitudes, for their outlook, the way they look at things, and to teach them that. And then that leads to actions. They're responsible for their behavior, for their conduct. There are consequences, and that leads us to the third thing, for their attitudes and their actions, and they're responsible for the consequences of those attitudes and those actions. Now, the fact of the matter is, all of us are accountable to God, aren't we? 2 Corinthians 5:10 said that all must give an account to God. We all must stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account of the deeds done in the body, whether they're good or whether they're evil. Well, you may be wondering if you're thinking about this list of A's that I've left one out. But if that's what you're thinking, here it is, and that's authority. And I have purposely left that to the last point, and I'll tell you why in a moment. First of all, let me point out that Jesus is our example in submitting to authority. In John chapter 14, verse 10, he said, the words that I speak to you, I do not speak by my own authority, but by the Father who dwells in me. And so even the Son of God understood that he was subject to the Father and to submit to his authority. I'm under the authority of the Lord. I'm subject to his discipline. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 6 said, the Lord disciplines those whom he loves. And so I need to teach my children they are responsible to authority and to discipline them and to help them realize that discipline is a sign of love. We've lost sight of that in so many homes in America today. And I hope and pray that in God's family that we not lose sight of that and we understand the importance of that. If we had more time, we would talk about this in some detail. In fact, that this was an interactive Bible class, we'd talk about this some. But I'll leave it with you maybe to talk about when you get home or talk with others. But I want to suggest to you that there are four parenting styles when it comes to the idea of authority. There is one, the autocratic parent. And the autocratic parent says, you do it my way or else. I mean, they crack the whip and they lay down the law. They're like a drill sergeant. It's autocratic. And then there's the style of a permissive parent. The permissive parent says, well, you can pretty much do what you want. And they do leave their kids to do whatever they want to do. And then closely aligned to that is a neglectful parent who even goes a step farther and says, I really don't care what you do. And unfortunately, in our world today, we see some parents that are neglectful and really don't care. But there's a fourth style, and I call this the relational style. And the relational style of parenting says that I am listening. I care about you. I want to understand how you feel. But has to say, this time, we're going to do it this way because. And it is relational. In Josh McDowell's book, he says, rules without relationship leads to rebellion. Sometimes in the Lord's church, we overreact because we see so many permissive and neglectful parents. And because we see that, then we think we need a bunch of rules. You know, I learned something in rearing children very early on. Never make a rule that you can't enforce. You know, sometimes parents get so caught up in so many rules. But if you make a rule that either you can't enforce or doesn't really have any consequences for breaking the rule, what good is the rule? The rule didn't do any good. And if you don't have a good relationship with your children, this is one reason, in my opinion at least, why I've seen through the years so many Christians in Christian homes, their children rebelling because they have laid down a bunch of rules without building a relationship with their children. Rules without relationship leads to rebellion. Now, the Bible puts it this way in Ephesians 6:4, fathers, do not overcorrect your children or make it difficult for them to obey the commandment. And so when we are autocratic and we overcorrect, we make it difficult for them to obey. Or in Colossians 3:21, Paul put it this way, don't exasperate your children so that they may not lose heart. Some children lose heart. They become discouraged because they're exasperated that they can never please. And I think he said, you know, no matter what I do, Dad's not pleased. No matter what I do, Mom's not pleased. You don't want to be that kind of parent. And when you are, you're violating Ephesians 3 and verse 21. And so this is what McDowell means. Rules without relationship leads to rebellion. But as I was studying this one time, I thought, you know, the flip side of that is also true. Ken Welliver says relationship without rules leads to resentment. In other words, if you try to be such a buddy-buddy to your kids that you're their best buddy and you don't have any rules and there's not any accountability, then kids will actually resent it that there's no boundaries. Believe it or not, your kids do want boundaries. Even your teenage children, they want boundaries. Because boundaries say, I love you and I care about you and I want to protect you. And so they need some rules. But trying to have a relationship without any rules oftentimes leads to the problem of resentment. Well, there we are. Raising kids without raising your blood pressure. Acceptance, appreciation, affection, availability, accountability, and all of it based upon authority. Let me take the last couple minutes and just close with this little piece that an unknown author wrote. And I would dedicate it to you, especially you young mothers, and several of you are here in the room tonight with your children, and I admire you and appreciate you for that. This author writes, one of these days you shout, why don't you kids grow up and act your age? And they will. Or you better go outside and find something to do and don't slam the door. And they will. You straighten up the boys' bedrooms, tidy and neat, bumper stickers discarded, spread tucked and smooth, toys displayed on the shelves, hangers in the closet, animals cage, and you say to yourself, I want it to stay that way. And it will. You prepared a perfect dinner with a salad that hasn't been picked to death and a cake with no finger traces and the icing. And you say, now there's a meal fit for company. And you eat it alone. You say, I want complete privacy on the phone. No dancing around, no pantomimes, no demolition crews. Silence, you hear. And you'll have it. No more plastic tablecloths stained with spaghetti. No more bedspreads to protect damp bottoms. No more gates to stumble over at the top of the basement stairs. No more clothespins under the sofa. No more playpens to arrange the room around. No more anxious nights under a vaporizer tent. No more sand on the sheets, Popeye movies in the bathroom, or iron-on patches, or wet knotted shoestrings, tight boots or rubber bands for ponytails. And imagine a lipstick with a point on it. No babysitter for New Year's Eve. Washing only once a week. Seeing a steak that isn't ground. Having your teeth cleaned without a baby on your lap. No PTA meetings, no carpools, no blaring radios. No one washing your hair until 11 o'clock at night. Having your own roll of transparent tape. Think about it. No more Christmas gifts made out of toothpicks and paste. No more sloopy oatmeal kisses. No more tooth fairy. No more giggles in the dark. No needles to heal. No responsibility. Only a voice crying, why don't you grow up? And the echo, I did. You see, ladies and gentlemen, our time is short. And take it from me and my wife, those 18 years go by so quick, and you look back and you wonder, how in the world did we reach this point in life? And your kids are grown, married, and gone from home. And what you did during that time in raising your kids will make a difference, not only in time, but very possibly in eternity. Home improvement calls for us to really think about the importance of raising our children the way that God wants them to. So tonight we close our service with a song of invitation, encouragement. If there's one here that owes a duty to God, there's some way in which we can help you in making your life right with God. We'd like to invite you to stand and sing as we sing the song, I'm Coming, Lord.
I hear thy word.